4 years ago, William Powers and his family decided to stop using the internet on weekends. No searching the web, no catching up on email, and no checking for sports scores on smartphones or Blackberries. He discusses this so-called internet Sabbath in the context of a long history of individuals struggling to find balance every time a new communication technology is introduced. In his new book, Hamlet's Blackberry, it's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Great to be here.
You've said that turning off the modem at your house every weekend has been a positive experience for your family. What led you to take that step?
You know, it was really just an experiment. It was very ad hoc. My wife and I noticed that our family life was sort of deteriorating very slowly the more connected we got digitally to the outside world and even to each other through our screens and handhelds and so forth. The less time we were really spending at home together, really kind of conversation, eye contact, all those things that families have always done and should do. And so we just decided, based on the old-fashioned idea of a weekend as sort of time apart, time to refresh yourself, recharge, to just unplug the modem and see what happened if we left it unplugged 2 days a week. Unplug it Friday, come back on Monday. And that was, as you said, we're in our fourth year of it now, and it's been amazing.
Of course, it's easier on the weekend when fewer important messages are sent by email. Your wife is Martha Sherald, also right. A writer, and she's been a guest on our show. But you have a son who was 9 years old at the time. How did he feel about being disconnected every weekend?
Well, as you can imagine, Leonard, he was the one who protested the most. 9 years old is sort of, I think, that age when people are really accelerate their connectedness in our society today. And he was in the process of that, you know, enjoying all these wonderful devices. And I do think they're all wonderful. And he was getting a lot out of them. But of course, at that age, he wasn't quite ready to see the point of a Sabbath, of what we call a Sabbath, which, by the way, has no religious content at all. It's just about the devices. So yes, he protested. And on the first weekend, which was incredibly hard for all of us, total withdrawal, he was the one who was yelling, "Bring back the internet."
My guest is William Powers. He's written a book called Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. It's published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've written that many of us are guided today by a philosophy you've called digital maximalism. Is that your term?
It's my term. I was struggling to come up with a phrase, you know, as I started working on the book. I wanted to summarize this approach that we've all adopted really unwittingly, I think. Well, I shouldn't say all of us. Many of us have adopted, and I certainly had adopted in my life, which is basically the more connected you are, the better, day and night. I think essentially that's how many of us are living. That's how I was living. When I traveled and I found myself in a place without cell phone coverage or an internet connection, I felt lost, incredibly frustrated, as if I needed to be plugged in all the time. So I thought that phrase sort of captured it. It's a little bit wordy, a few too many syllables, but for me it worked.
Isn't the ability to respond rapidly to new stimulus an advantage in genetic terms?
I don't know about in genetic terms. In human terms, it definitely is. You know, I think connecting is the essence of a good life. You know, people began isolated from each other in primitive times. I recount this briefly in the book. People didn't even know how to have conversation. They hadn't invented speaking yet. When they learned to speak, really, that was the beginning of so much that we have today. And it was followed by writing and painting and all these music, all these amazing forms of connectedness we have, right up to the digital ones. But there is a downside to too much connectedness, to connectedness taken to excess. And I think it's a lesson that's been learned over and over in history. And it's one we feel particularly acutely today because our connectedness is so intense and we are able to be in touch with so many people so quickly all the time.
Almost every week, it seems, I see stories in the media about studies that suggest our use of technology may be damaging our memories and attention spans and destroying our ability to focus. You don't seem to be alarmed by that.
I'm not alarmed by it in the long term. There is a suggestion in some of these stories, and I've seen some of the ones you've seen, I think. There's a suggestion that we're doing permanent damage to ourselves, you know, that we're somehow restructuring the mechanics of our brains even. And I'm not on board for that. First of all, the brain research on this is very young. You know, we've only just begun because the devices are so new. So we don't know a lot. But second, I find in my own life, just taking these 2 days off a week, or whenever I take some time away from the devices, all that longer term, kind of longer attention span way of thinking that I missed when I was living as a maximalist comes back. You know, I just think it's states of mind that we're entering in and cycles of consciousness that are speeded up and too short term rather than something permanent we're doing to ourselves. You know, these fears you're talking about, Leonard, that are in these stories, they also have recurred throughout history when new technologies have come along.
Well, you've conceded that the use of a new technology has coincided with a change in the way people think, and you cite the development of the printing press in the 1400s by Johannes Gutenberg in Germany as having helped usher in an age of linear thinking. People weren't thinking in a linear way before?
Well, I was citing McLuhan there, and Marshall McLuhan's own theory about the birth of basically this linear thinking man, who he believed was a product of print. And I think McLuhan is onto something, you know, in a fundamental way, that print, you know, reshaped how we think about ourselves and society. I think all of that matters. I don't know if I would go as far as he went in the sense of we really built a new human being. In fact, one of the things I learned in my look back at history for this book, back to ancient Greece and then forward, is that people fundamentally don't change all that much. It's amazing how accessible and even modern at many moments Plato feels when you read Plato today. And it's why so many people read Plato, and if you Google his name, why you get gazillions of hits. So I think people are basically people through time.
Well, they were arguing the whole, even at that time, about the impact of the written word, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to stick with Gutenberg just a bit longer.
Yes.
Is the development of the printing press and left-brain thinking connected? Are they connected, as McLuhan suggested? And can we assume that the current proliferation of electronic media might be creating a society in which people think in a less linear way and are more group-oriented, more right-brain-oriented?
Mm-hmm. It's a very tricky question because, first of all, I don't have any good science on this, and I didn't find any science, you know, proving McLuhan's thesis that I thought was worth using. So I should caveat, I should base what I'm about to say as, you know, take it for what it's worth. It's a gut sense of mine based on my reading. I think that there is a way in which reading words on a page made us into more linear thinkers. But bear in mind that McLuhan was writing in the age when radio had been the dominant mode of communication, you know, his early years before television, which was an oral kind of communication. And he didn't see the dawn of what we're seeing now, which is essentially written words on a screen. So it's this hybrid of the writing with the television technology that he knew so well. So it's a question of whether we're going back to a kind of a more right brain way of being and thinking, because he tied that to orality, which in some ways is on the decline. As you know, people are using cell phones less and less for talking and more for texting.
A caller wonders if reading on a Kindle should be considered to be connected or disconnected.
Yeah, it's a good question. I get into that a little bit in that chapter about Gutenberg. I think if you're, by the way, I think these e-books have wonderful promise. And even today, for traveling, you know, the ability to carry 50 books with you in one book-sized gadget, I think is fantastic. But I do think that there is a fundamental difference between reading in true isolation, where you're not connected to the world and you don't have emails coming in on the side of the screen or links on the page that you can easily click away to. There's a difference between that and reading a traditional book, a book that is just its own object sitting in your hands where you can feel the texture of the pages and turn the pages. So I think that reading a Kindle is more connected in the broad sense of the word because you're connected to what I call the digital crowd than reading a traditional book.
Well, William, I have your book in my hand, and it's a traditional book. Your first, by the way. William Powers is a former staff writer for the Washington Post. He's written about media, technology, and other subjects for a wide variety of publications, including The Atlantic, The New York Times, and McSweeney's. And now this book, Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age, published by Harper. We will continue our conversation. We'll talk a bit about Plato and some other important people involved with, in fact, what he's called the seven philosophers of screens, after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with William Powers. His book, Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age, published by Harper's. And as we've been saying, you look back over the past 25 years, you identify seven individuals, and including Gutenberg, who had interesting ideas for understanding and dealing with innovations in technology that intensified human connectedness, but also were frightening to people at the time.
Right.
And you call them the seven philosophers of screens. The first, Plato. Weren't the people of ancient Greece, especially Plato's teacher Socrates, concerned that writing things down was becoming more popular?
Yes, there was, believe it or not, a lot of people are surprised to read this. People in Plato's time and Socrates' time were very worried, some of them, about the way writing, the alphabet, was catching on. And Socrates in particular, in this one dialogue I talk about in the book, voiced really deep concern that we wouldn't be able to think as well or as creatively with written language by reading and writing as we did, as Greeks long had done in conversation. And, of course, he was the master of conversation, so we can perhaps understand why he felt that way.
Yeah, also, we wouldn't memorize information if we were able to write it down.
Right.
But we wouldn't even know much about Socrates if Plato, Alcibiades, and others hadn't written down what he said.
No, it's true. That's the wonderful irony of this dialogue. Plato records his teacher raising all these grave concerns about writing in the very medium that Socrates was worried about. So we don't know much about Plato's own beliefs, but we can infer from that that he actually had a different view from his teacher.
You've also cited Lucius Annaeus Seneca, a philosopher in ancient Rome, who was an advisor to Nero at a time when the amount of written material people needed to deal with had exploded. Didn't he notice that people had started to skim things rather than to really focus on them?
Yes.
That sounds very contemporary.
It is. Seneca's incredibly contemporary. I was discovering Seneca for the first time in reading this book. I knew him as a source of aphorisms, but he turns out to be so much more than that. And Seneca writes about noticing that his friends had such a hard time keeping up with all the books that were being published in Rome and feeling that they were behind, that they started paying what he calls flying visits to books, just dipping into them to pick up little quotes they could use so they could pretend they'd read them. And I love that. It reminded me of Googling.
Mm-hmm. He said that letter writing helped him focus his thinking. Well, I'm not sure that sending email messages would be as appreciated by Seneca as letter writing.
No, he did this great experiment where he got himself into a room that was very noisy with all kinds of distractions outside the windows, and there was a spa right underneath the room where people were working out with weights and grunting, basically the kind of place where it's hard to focus your thoughts. And he decided to figure out if he could focus better by choosing one friend and sitting down with a piece of paper, or I guess in this case it would have been something like papyrus, and writing a letter to that one person. And he found it brought wonderful focus to just choose one subject, one person, and write for a while. And he used it kind of as a metaphor for what we can all do. You know, even when we live in busy, hectic times, as ancient Rome was in its way and as today is, we can be in control of our consciousness if we just think about it a little bit. That's sort of my message.
There's a scene in Shakespeare's Hamlet where Hamlet pulls out a notebook-like device. What was it called? The table?
It was called tables.
Mm-hmm. And I guess many people aren't familiar with the table. Can you describe it for us? And is this the inspiration for the title of your book, Hamlet's
Yes.
Blackberry?
Yes, the title of my book comes from this moment in Hamlet that is often overlooked, where Hamlet meets the ghost for the first time, the ghost of his father, who tells Hamlet, I wasn't killed by a serpent's bite, I was murdered. And Hamlet, you know, obviously is thrown into a bit of a panic, a nervous state by this news, this terrible news. And he says, "My tables, my tables." Now, when we in the audience hear that today, I think we tend to think of a coffee table or a kitchen table, because that's what the word generally means. But in fact, he meant this little device. It was kind of a booklet, but when you opened it up, it had a surface on it that was made of a plaster-like material, and you wrote on it during the day. You would take out a stylus, as like the styluses we have today on some of our gadgets, and you could write notes on it, to-do lists, things you wanted to remember from the day, et cetera. And then at night, the beauty of this invention was you could erase it clean, which was a new thing for people in Elizabethan times.
So it was like a blackboard. But yeah. But I imagine table and tablet are connected.
They're connected, and it was a great innovation. It caught on wildly, and people actually wrote and spoke about how they couldn't go anywhere without their tables.
Ben Franklin is another person on your list of seven. Didn't he have some good ideas for how to deal with his busy and cluttered life?
Yes, Franklin realized in his 20s that he was going off in too many directions. He was really addicted to what today we call social networking. He had too many people in his life. He had too many drives driving him in too many directions, including his really often out-of-control sex drive. And he realized that he needed to rein it in and impose some order on it. And what he did was he was carrying around a set of tables just like the ones that are in Hamlet. They were still popular a couple hundred years later. And he used this little almanac that he wrote on to have a list of sort of goals that he was aiming for in his life, so that he was basically not too busy, too overconnected, or too controlled by these various drives of him. And he made them all very positive goals. So he felt he talked too much. So one of his goals that he had on his list of what he called his virtues was silence. He would pursue more silence during the day. 60-some years later, when he looked back on his life and his autobiography, he attributed all his success and everything wonderful that he'd achieved to this simple ritual of keeping track of those ideas with a little device in his pocket.
And people do that still, don't they?
They do.
They keep tape recorders, or they write down little notes.
They do.
You keep a moleskin, I gather?
Yes, I carry around a moleskin, one of the simplest versions of those wonderful moleskin tablets that are or notebooks that are sold in bookstores everywhere now. I carry around one of the smaller ones, and I use it really to sort of take all this information that feels like it's swirling around me every day, and again, impose some order on it, choose the information that matters most to me, and then at the end of the day or every couple of days, I transcribe it into my digital files.
At the start of your book, you write about your friend Marie, who'd only recently immigrated to the United States and was still learning English. And every time you ran into her and asked her how she was, she would give you the same answer.
Yeah. Marie, who's a really sweet person, would look at me with a big smile, and I would say, "How are you, Marie?" And she would say, "I'm busy, very busy." And it would be as if she was delivering this amazing news that she was busy, which doesn't really make sense. And I realized after a while she was imitating what she had seen English speakers, Americans, saying to each other all the time, not in greeting so much as just describing their lives, "I'm very busy, I'm busy," which is what we do say to each other all the time as an excuse, as an update. She thought it was a greeting. She heard it so often she thought it was a greeting, so that became her greeting for a while.
Do you think that we are any busier than people were in the past?
I think we are busier than we were, say, 20 years ago. I think these devices have made us busier in large part because of the way we've decided to use them, so that in a way we've used digital technology to make ourselves busier, and I think we've made ourselves busier than we need to be. I think we could use these devices more effectively so we don't feel as crazed, so we don't feel life is spinning out of control because of what should be wonderfully useful and helpful devices.
My guest is William Powers. His book, Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age, published by Harper. We have been asking our listeners, my Facebook friends, to share their tips on how to carve out some offline time. Matthew on Facebook says that he goes camping to a place where there's no Wi-Fi or a cell phone reception. In a way, isn't he doing what Thoreau did? Because Thoreau came along at a time when the railroads and the telegraph were transforming people's lives, he felt the need to get away.
Thoreau did. Thoreau also writes very entertainingly of the addiction people in his time had to going to the post office to check their mail, how people would go multiple times during the day just to keep checking. And he says, in proportion as a man's inward life fails, he goes more constantly and desperately to the post office. I love that. But yes, your Facebook friend Matthew is indeed doing something very similar, spending some time away from civilization and from all this connectedness in order to get back in touch with his inward life, really. And I think that's wonderful. That's what we do on weekends in my family.
Well, with Thoreau not going to the post office, that wasn't all that different than people deciding not to look at their BlackBerries or their iPhones until the movie is already past the opening credits.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's that idea of you don't have to be a slave to the technology. You can love the technology and make effective use of it without turning it into a leash that leads you around all day. It's a simple principle, but we need to learn it over and over again, Leonard, because each new technology brings such excitement and enthusiasm that we tend to get caught up in it.
From our Facebook page, Steve wrote, I'm embarrassed to admit this. I give a trusted friend my email, Twitter, and Facebook password, and then I ask them to change it and not tell me what it is until my vacation is over.
That's a new one. I have never heard that. That is brilliant.
Well, but it's pretty much the same idea, isn't it? Except that he doesn't trust himself, I suspect.
Yes, you know, way back in Plato's time, Socrates basically admits in that dialogue we talked about that he was addicted to the oral connectedness of his time, that he hated leaving Athens because it meant getting away from conversation, which was the dominant way of connecting. We're the same way. We really love it for a lot of good reasons. It's hard to swear off it, so we have to come up with these what seem like awkward and even ridiculous rituals and devices to get away from it, but it's important. It's worth doing.
A listener says, I don't own a cell phone, nor do I have cable, so no TV. I don't have a Facebook page. My entertainment is minimal compared to my friends. I read books, listen to the radio, and borrow movies from various libraries. I read my personal email 2 to 3 times a week. That's it. Now, I'm not sure that I'm sure that he's feeling very good about himself, but I remember when I was very proud of the fact that I didn't have a TV when I was younger, and somebody asked me, well, how the heck do you know what's really going on in the culture? And I realized that you do need to have some kind of connectedness to know what's going on, don't you?
Well, you do, you know, and we tend to forget that everything that listener just cited is a kind of connectedness. Books are a kind of connectedness. You know, everything is a kind of connectedness, and the trick is to set up something that works for you. I say this in the book. I'm not trying to preach to people or prescribe. I'm not telling people you should have an internet Sabbath on weekends. We all have different tolerances. There are extroverts. There are introverts. There's all kinds of different feelings about technology. So I think each of us should design our own life. And if that works for that listener, that's terrific. I need more technological connectedness and feeling of being in touch with what's happening in the digital world than that person does.
On Facebook, Linda says she turns off the news unless she's really listening to it. She doesn't want to leave it on as just background noise.
See, now I'm different from Linda, too. I actually like to have the news on when I'm cooking in the kitchen so that it kind of comes and goes in my consciousness. I love that feeling of radio while I'm cooking. And if I'm not catching a few stories, that's fine with me.
So, what happens is suddenly something will enter into your consciousness, and you catch something that you might not have been aware of otherwise.
Yeah, and it feels a bit like happenstance, but it also feels like whatever it is that caught my ear earned it in a way, you know? And so I like the organic feeling. Radio, I mean, I know we're on radio now, so I'm biased, but it does have that feeling of participating in the decision of the degree to which you're going to pay attention, which is very different from staring at a screen, which feels like I'm less of a decider in what's going to happen next.
Caitlin asks, if critics freaked out about people staying home and never communicating face-to-face when the telephone became popular.
It's true. It happens every time. And as you know, there was a great deal of concern about television creating a vast wasteland of basically of people who couldn't think anymore. And it didn't turn out to be true. You know, what I've found in my research, Leonard, is that the folks at the two ends of the spectrum the people who feel we're remaking the human race with a technology at one end, and the people who feel we're destroying humanity at the other, both tend to be wrong. And the truth winds up being somewhere between.
But how much of this is also generational?
I think some of it is, but I get into this in the book. I actually don't think it's ultimately a generational problem. Remember, I grew up in the television age. The TVs were brought into my life by grown-ups. They were invented by them, and they were installed in my house by my parents. So, you know, we were all participating in the move to the new technological age. Younger people tend to be more comfortable with a new technology because they take it for granted. But I do think we all go through this change together, and there's something sort of invidious about saying, oh, digital natives are different, and they're completely a new kind of person. I don't buy into that. I think we're making this transition together, and if there is a difference between the generations, we can help each other make it.
Your kid is now, what, 14, your son?
12.
12. Is he still, has he continued to accept the situation, or is he pressing you to allow at least a little internet connectedness during the weekends?
You know what? He doesn't press us. He really became a believer over the last, a little over 3 years, and it's been wonderful. He still loves his digital life, but he really sees the value of those days off. Last night I gave a local reading at our bookstore in my hometown here in Massachusetts, and one of the people in the audience asked the question you just asked, and my son stood up and got up in the front of the audience with me and explained his view, and this is exactly what he said. He said, no, it's been terrific, and I completely believe in it. He even tries to convince his friends to give it a try.
I'm sure they're not buying that.
Not with much success, I will admit.
Meanwhile, this is a kind of a middle-of-the-road story here, you're not saying we should throw away our computers. You're not at the same time saying that we should remain connected every day. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's all about balance, Leonard, and I've loved being here talking to you.
Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. It is published by Harper. Thank you again, William Powers.
Thank you.